Welcome to Studio 2 on the eve of Independence Day. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The show today will revolve around a single question. Do you think President Joe Biden should end his reelection campaign? Word broke just today, this morning, from the New York Times that Biden himself is talking about this possibility with key allies high up in the party. So we're asking you, should the sitting president end his reelection campaign? We will talk about this with a panel of experts. And again, we really want to hear from you. Studio2@whyy.org is our email address. Our number is 888-477-9499.
And thank you to the folks who've already emailed, to the people who are commenting on Facebook. We want to hear what you think. And we're going to jump into right on into the news. Big story today is about climate change. New data shows that Delaware and New Jersey are two of the fastest warming states in the country. This data comes from a nonprofit called Climate Central, and they say Delaware is the second fastest warming state in the country. New Jersey, right behind it at the third fastest warming one. Annual temperatures in New Jersey are up 3.5 degrees since 1970, 3.6 degrees up. In Delaware, the national average is just about 2.5 degrees during
those
years.
That's a huge difference.
That's a huge difference. And we're talking about
1 degree above normal.
Yeah. And we're talking about, what does this mean, right? It means we're going to have more heat waves. We could have more flooding. And you're probably asking, why? Why is this happening?
Yeah, why New Jersey
and
Delaware?
They have coast, you know, these big coastal areas, which means they have close proximity to fast warming oceans. They also have overdevelopment, lots of concrete, big buildings,
those
all
urban
those
heat islands, yeah,
causing heat in their state. And so, yeah, critics say, though, that, you know, putting together these lists doesn't help. We need to be talking about solutions for keeping these states cool.
Critics say we can't put together lists.
Look, that was one of the things in the article.
We can't tell people that New Jersey and Delaware are warming
and because
faster
of the
average.
Differences between the states is less than the tenth. Like it's very small differential between the states. The bottom line is that the United States is getting warmer. The other thing I thought was interesting in this article, Avi, is that the entire Northeast is getting warmer.
Yeah. And I felt kind of silly. I did not know that New Jersey and Delaware.
Yeah,
were,
I didn't know either.
I didn't realize that proximity to ocean was likely to lead to faster warming temperatures. Mm-hmm. Obviously, I understand ocean rise is a huge threat from climate change. Mm-hmm. But I'll admit, I was ignorant about this. So the list helped me, at least. I don't know.
Yeah. And by the way, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Vermont, and New Hampshire, all in the top 10.
The Inquirer reported late yesterday that longtime sports radio personality Howard Eskin has been banned from Citizens Bank Park, where the Phillies play, for the remainder of the season. Normally, he would be there all the time. Why is he banned? Well, a ballpark employee says the 73-year-old Eskin gave her an unwanted kiss, and Eskin was barred from the ballpark after an investigation by his employer, Odyssey. That's the company that owns WIP Sports Radio, where Eskin works and has worked for a long time. He will remain on the air. And for the uninitiated, Eskin is a founding sports radio personality in this market, arguably the most famous sports radio personality in this market. He was the first person to host a sports radio show on WIP and one of the station's founding stars.
Wow. I have to say, Avi, you know, I was kind of surprised to hear that he was banned from Citizens Bank Park. But at the same time, I was pleased to know that when an employee of the park spoke up, the company took the allegations seriously. They investigated. And when the allegations were corroborated, they took action. We'll see what steps Odyssey ends up, you know, taking in response. But right now he's going to stay on air. But at the end of the day, you know, Citizens Bank Park has to protect their employees. And I think about how far we've come, you know, with women being able to, or people being able to sort of report uncomfortable situations, like I'm sure this was, and having your employer back you up. And especially when you're dealing with somebody who's a legend in the city of Philadelphia, like Howard Eskin.
Absolutely. And, you know, you said that you were happy there are consequences. He is remaining on the air, is keeping his job. And as far as we know, there is no plans to do anything further.
Well, something that could be good or bad for Pennsylvania is a bill that would allow the Commonwealth to see more happy hours.
Explain.
Let me explain. It's House Bill 829. It's pending in the Pennsylvania House. It would allow bars and restaurants to have up to 24 hours worth of happy hours every single week.
Over the course of the
week.
Over
the course of the week.
To be clear.
Yeah. Not like a no.
If you do one full day, then you're out for the week.
Yeah. And
okay.
Currently, the law only allows 14 hours of happy hours. So 2 hours a day, right? And you could divide it. You could be 3 hours, mm-hmm. 5 days, whatever you want to mm-hmm. do, right? So now it will give them this 10 extra hours. And lawmakers argue that it could increase business for establishments. It could provide more marketing opportunities. It could allow up to 2 happy hours a day. You can have drink and food specials. It opens the world up for these restaurants and bars. What do you think? I love a happy hour.
I was shocked that there was a limit on happy hours.
Oh, you thought it was like happy hour for all.
I just thought the business got to determine whether or not it had a happy hour. But it does make sense in Pennsylvania, which has always really tightly controlled liquor distribution and the way bars function and alcohol serving. You know, we still have our state stores and everything. So mm-hmm. Pennsylvania is an unusual state. It did remind me that Pennsylvania has had these blue laws for a long, long time, like dating back to like William Penn days. There have been laws around this stuff, and a lot of it was around alcohol, but also like what you could do on Sundays. And it reminded me that in the 30s they had to pass a law so that they could play sports on Sunday to allow the NFL to take root, like the Steelers and the Eagles, to basically get going, because it was a law you could not play sports on Sunday in Pennsylvania.
Wow.
They had to get a whole law passed just to change that.
I love that you brought
that. That's like less than 100 years ago.
Yeah. I love you always provide this historical perspective.
Do you really love it?
Was that a headline of yours? Was that a headline of yours?
I will admit it was a headline of yours. I think it was my first ever headline of yours, actually. Yes.
Look at you dusting it off. I love it. I love it.
So I might have some of the details wrong. It's been a long, long time, I will admit.
And I'll say this last point is likely that it will pass, because last year, a previous version of the bill sailed through the House 199-2, and it passed the Senate with only 3 nays.
Cheers to that.
Yeah, cheers. So happy hour.
And you might be happy tomorrow as you celebrate July 4th. Hopefully you have some time off. I think you guys know, not breaking any news here, that July 4th as a holiday is tied to events that happened here in Philadelphia. So the city's always doing lots of stuff on the 4th. Lots of museums are free tomorrow. Cherry, if you didn't know. You got National Constitution Center and Museum of American Jewish History, free admission, both of those. Special programming at the Museum of the American Revolution. You got the parade in Center City at 11.
Yeah.
Willie Nelson's 4th of July picnic. That's a whole concert going on in Camden. Bob Dylan's going to be there.
Ooh.
Robert Plant, Alison Krauss. Mm-hmm. You're a huge Dylan fan. I know that, Cherry.
Mm-hmm. and, I like Dylan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bob Dylan. Yeah.
Why not?
Yeah, let's
blowing
lean
in the wind.
Yeah, that's right.
Times they are a-changing.
That's right. Sing it.
Like a Rolling Stone. I could just list Bob Dylan songs all day. And then, of course, we got the concert and the fireworks on the parkway at night. Neo and Kesha will perform.
Ooh.
Two really close musical siblings to Bob Dylan in a lot of ways, I think. So,
And it's free.
That's free. That's true.
That's free on the parkway. That's that used true. To be the thing that I would do, but I will be at work tomorrow. So if you're listening to WHRY 90.9, which I hope you will,
why wouldn't you?
Why wouldn't you? Yeah, you'll hear my voice. But happy 4th.
What are you doing for the 4th, Chair?
I'm going to make some jerk chicken wings and sit and.
Why in that voice?
I'm just letting you know that that's my chef voice.
that's
my at-home cook voice. I will be making some jerk chicken wings, some kind of nice little, meal, and sitting outside and watching the fireworks.
Got a lot of questions about the chef voice.
Yes.
I don't think that's how chefs talk, but go ahead.
That's how chef.
That's how chef Cherry.
That's how I talk. But anyway, coming up, we're going to get serious for the show. Coming up, President Joe Biden, we've asked this question. This is the question for today. President Joe Biden, should he end his reelection campaign? That is our big question for today's show. We have three great guests standing by to discuss this, and we want to hear from you.
In fact, our producer, Andreas Copes, was on the streets of Philadelphia yesterday speaking with voters. Here's what some of them had to say.
I think the stakes are too high at this point to risk him running. I mean, I think someone else needs to jump in.
I have drank the Biden Kool-Aid, okay? That's the way you want to put it. I think that we will win because this country cannot stand another 4 years of Trump. They can.
I think that replacing Biden would cause chaos and fragmenting the Democratic Party. Some people are going to be mad if Kamala Harris isn't the replacement.
I'm actually kind of disappointed. That's the best we can do.
And to give you a sense of how divided people are on this particular topic, we have emails from Brian and Brian. Brian says, yes, 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 he should step down. The other Brian says, you are voting for an administration, not necessarily a candidate. So even Brian's are not aligned on Biden. And so again, the email is studio2@whyy.org. You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. Today, we're going to be hearing from Solomon Jones, columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer and a WURD host, Dave Davies, guest host for NPR's Fresh Air and a former WHYY political reporter, and Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. And we want to hear from you. Studio2@WHYY.org.
The question, should President Biden end his re-election campaign? I look forward to hearing your thoughts. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. The New York Times reported this morning that President Biden is acknowledging he may not be able to salvage his campaign. A new article by Katie Rogers quotes a close ally of the president who says Biden is seriously wondering whether he can recover from the debate and the public's reaction to it.
Calls for President Biden to withdraw from the race, they haven't stopped since the debate. In fact, yesterday, Democratic Representative Lloyd Doggett called for the president to step aside. He's the first sitting lawmaker to do so. Other prominent Democratic voices have asked him to drop out. And they include strategist James Carville, Andrew Yang, Tim Ryan, and the New York Times editorial page. But until this new report, it appeared that Biden, the vice president, his family, aides, and surrogates were all behind his candidacy.
But Cherry, even if Biden were to withdraw, the process to replace him at the convention could be messy. And depending on who emerges as the nominee, it could alienate a lot of voters. So what should the president do? Do Democrats have a better chance against President Trump with another person at the top of the ticket? And who should that person be? We have a trio of guests with us to weigh those questions. Solomon Jones is a columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer and a WURD radio host. Solomon, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
Dave Davies is a guest host for NPR's Fresh Air and a former WHYY political reporter. Dave, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you guys again.
And Julian Zelizer is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He's the co-editor of a new book out this month, Our Nation at Risk, Election Integrity as a National Security Issue. Julian Zelizer, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Do you think Biden should leave the race? Call us, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
And so, panelists, big brains on this topic, I got to ask you, this new report from the New York Times, the first that we've heard of, saying that the president himself is considering whether he can regain the public's trust and confidence and whether he should step aside. I want to get your reaction to this. Dave, I'll start with you, Solomon, and then we'll go to Julian.
Yeah, Dave. I think we shouldn't go jumping off the bridge on this report. I mean, it's pretty conditional. What it says is that he told this unnamed key ally that he knows he may not be able to salvage his candidacy if he cannot convince the public in the coming days he's up to the job. So I think what he's saying is what's kind of obvious. The stakes are high. There are risks. And he's got to demonstrate something with some events he has planned in the coming days.
Yeah, well, let me ask you, though, as a follow-up, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
it's never a mistake that these things get to the New York Times, right? Yeah. These are usually trial balloons. I mean, what do you make of the fact that this is even in the New York Times?
Well, I don't know. It would be guessing to know who this the source of this story is. I mean, I think he's talking to people and his close friends are talking to people, and some of that's going to get in the hands of reporters. But again, you know, it's not like he's saying, I'm really thinking about dropping out. He says, I know that there's a problem here and I'm going to have to address it.
And Solomon, I want to get your voice in on this, your reaction, but also he has an interview with a prominent journalist coming up, more campaign. What does he need to do? Your reaction and what he needs to do to regain confidence.
Well, I think as far as the New York Times piece is concerned, I think it's important to say that the White House denied the piece. So that happened. I think that's important to say. The other thing I think is that that's what a wise leader would do. You want to know what the people want. Do they want you? Do they want someone else? And if so, who? I think it's wise of him to be considering whether or not he should drop out, whether or not he should continue, and basing that on whether or not he can win. I think this is a very high stakes election. Mm-hmm. I think he realizes that. I think the Democratic Party realizes that. And I think that everyone should take a breath and decide what's best, not only for the party, but for the country.
Julian Zelizer, can you join the conversation now and perhaps address this latest report, but also talk a little bit, just get us up to speed a little bit on the historical precedent for a conversation like this?
Yeah, on the report, it makes sense. I'm sure he is hearing and thinking about what everyone else is saying, and he's under pressure, and he wants to win not only for himself, but I do think he believes that the threat of a second term under Donald Trump would be great. In terms of the precedent, it's not great, meaning, you know, in 1968, as the prime example, President Lyndon Johnson, in the middle of Vietnam, decided he would not run for re-election, announces that on March 31st, his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, becomes the nominee. It doesn't calm the problems. The war rages, the party remains divided, and ultimately a Republican Richard Nixon won. So that precedent, similarly with Harry Truman not running in 1952 and Dwight Eisenhower winning, suggests there are great risks in terms of abandoning him. And that's why Democrats do have to take a breath and think through the decision, because there's no inevitability of victory if they jettison the president and move to another candidate.
And I got to ask about my question. I want to throw it out here again. What does he need to do? Like, because what would be critical in the coming days for him to regain the public's confidence? And Dave, I'll throw it to you.
Well, you know, he's got an interview Friday with George Stephanopoulos, right? And then a couple of big campaign events in swing states over the weekend. And if, you know, he goes 3-for-3, if he comes out and it's the State of the Union Joe Biden, where he is crisp and clear and cogent, I think that helps. That helps. I don't think that you're ever going to erase the memories of that catastrophic performance in the debate, but it would probably – it's hard to say. I mean, nobody really knows what's going to happen, but I think it would probably make him feel better. I mean, I think he's got to wonder himself, how much do I have in the tank? I mean, I'm not his age, but I'm old enough to feel the effects of aging, and it does make you think, hey, you know, how many at-bats do I have left?
Solomon, how about you?
I think that one of the problems with Democrats in general is that they tend to have these long, rambling explanations for everything. They tend to have long facts and figures for everything. They tend to depend on these studies. Studies say, and no, you need 3 talking points. You need a message. And you need to be very adamant and very energetic about it. I think that's what Biden needs to do. One of the things that I noticed in the debate was that Donald Trump went back to immigration no matter what they asked him. Mm-hmm. What about the economy? Mm-hmm. Oh, it's these immigrants. What about, you know, the
healthcare
inflation?
Costs.
What about healthcare? Right. What about anything? And he went back to immigrants. That was his talking point. I think Joe Biden needs to get 3 talking points. He needs to hammer those talking points, and he needs to run on his record. His record is strong. The economy, despite what everybody is telling us, is strong. Stock market is up. Everything's going well. And I think he needs to really focus on his record, on 3 talking points about his record, and and just run on that. I think he needs to stay in the race. Nobody else is polling anywhere near Biden on the Democratic side.
Yeah, and I think we should bring in a caller here. Yeah.
And look, all this comes back to the debate performance. Yeah. There were concerns before that, but the debate really accelerated those concerns. And we have a caller, Susan, who's on the line, who is a physician who can talk about Biden's performance that night. Susan, you're on Studio 2. What is your question or comment?
Well, observation. Just a little background. I'm a licensed clinical social worker, which means a therapist, and I've been doing this for 30 years. When he walked out on the stage, he looked like he was not in his most rested, attentive side. As soon as he opened his mouth, there was an issue, you know, with hoarseness, which to me is an indication of not of illness or not feeling well. And as he proceeded, he had the answers, but he didn't have the vim and vigor behind it. This was one night, and my assessment, if he was coming in my office, I would take his temperature and call in his caretakers. Like, he should be resting. He should be in bed. This is not a time for a 90-minute debate, no matter how important it is.
Thank you so much for that comment, Susan. And Marie echoes a lot of what you say. This is a comment from Marie. I believe the Inquirer got it right in their Saturday op-ed. Trump should be the candidate stepping down, as he has clearly demonstrated he is unfit for the office. Joe had a bad night, but has done more for this country since FDR. He has my full support. That's what Marie is saying. Julian Zelizer, talk about the difference between the parties right now and their reaction to their candidates when their candidates make missteps. I mean, Jerry has talked about this before. It just seems like there's a core disunity within the Democratic Party that does not exist on the other side. Is that unusual historically, or is that a balance we often see?
We've seen it recently with the parties. I think it's not simply disunity versus unity. That is there. So the Republicans will rally around their candidate, even if he is convicted, whereas Democrats, after a bad night, scramble and talk about pushing him off the ticket. Part of it are different concerns. I mean, I do think Democrats in this era are still more concerned about many governing issues, and they fear a Trump presidency. And so the question isn't simply, can Biden be president in a second term? It's the risk of losing to Donald Trump, which they see as very grave to the democracy, not just to the party and to public policy. But it's pretty stark. And listener who said Trump should be the one who resigns, that's not going to happen. And the party isn't going to call for it. And so that fundamental difference is a reality. And again, we've seen this play out for two or three decades at this point. It's an asymmetry in how partisanship works in each party.
And I got to ask a follow-up question to you, Solomon, and Dave, feel free to weigh in here, because one of the lines that I heard over the past few days came from Michael Steele, former head of the RNC, who said that Democrats need to take a lesson from the GOP on how to be ride or die.
Yeah.
And California Governor Gavin Newsom said Democrats, their panic wasn't unfounded, but it was unhelpful. Do you think the Democrats botched the whole response to the debate debacle by starting the step down Biden, mantra prematurely?
Yes, I do. I think that there should be some lessons that the Democrats should learn from 2016. I covered the DNC when it was here in 2016. Dave, I'm sure you did too. And there were Bernie Sanders protesters outside the convention because Bernie Sanders lost. And so you had this disunity. You had Bernie Sanders sitting there looking like a sore loser and refusing to really get behind Hillary Clinton. And that disunity was one of the reasons that Trump got into the office in the first place. And so Democrats need to look at their recent history and know that they have to unify in order to win. If they don't, they will lose. And that's just the reality that they're facing right now. And the fact that you can't look at your recent history and know that is disturbing.
Let me bring in another caller, because I think this is going to set up something for Dave Davies about what it would actually take here to make a change. So Keir, and I hope I have your name right, Keir is calling from Philadelphia and wants to talk about how it is too late to make changes to the ticket. You're on Studio 2, Keir. What is your question or comment?
Hey, I have a comment, and I really do agree with what the comment the last person made. But I do think right now we're going to be more disruptive than helpful to the agenda that we've already been setting. And we've got to remember, this is bigger than one person. This is about teams and policies and practices assembled under that administration to keep us on a progressive path. If Trump gets in, those teams will be dismantled. And we will be looking at a new chart in course of a path, which is the 2025 Republican plan. We have to get out of our own heads on starting to idolize a person and idolize an ideology and idea of how we advance things for our communities through the different administrations and different committees that are created under an administration. And I think that's where we have to stop talking about Biden as a singular and talk about us as a collective.
Eloquently put. Thank you so much for that comment. Dave Davies, I want to bring you back into the conversation now because it would be complicated to switch things up at this point. There is a decent amount of time. Lots of stuff will probably change between now and November. But give us a lay of the land. How would a candidate swap potentially work, and what are the potential tripwires in there?
Well, it could work. I mean, if it all depends upon Joe Biden deciding to step out of the race. If he doesn't, there's no one's going to force him out, I don't think. Mm-hmm. But should he do that, I mean, the convention is 7 weeks away. There are 4,600 delegates. 85% of them are already committed Biden delegates. The others are so-called superdelegates, you know, the elected officials, the party leaders. The party rules changed in 2018 so that superdelegates cannot vote on the first ballot. Mm. You know, there was a concern that these party folks would come in and essentially have ignore the will of the voters as expressed in primaries and just do whatever they wanted. And so the party said, okay, let's just change the rules. So from now on, you get your credentials, you have a good time at the convention, but you can't vote on the first ballot unless it's essentially unanimous. So what you'd have is a convention in which the great majority of the people there were selected by the Biden team and are more or less committed to Biden. I mean, the rules are a little fuzzy on that. But if Biden were, for example, to say, I'm going to step aside and I think we should support Kamala Harris for the post, I think it's highly likely that she would secure a majority of those ballots on the first of those delegates on the first ballot and would become the nominee. Other people would be unhappy, I'm sure. Others could campaign. If Biden didn't step down, people could still declare their candidacy and make their cases to those delegates. But I don't think it would get that far, given who they are. You know, the other question is, what about the $91 million in President Biden's campaign fund?
Yeah, this money. Yeah.
There are rules about that. And in fact, I mean, Kamala Harris, if she were the nominee, could take full control of that money. It is a Biden-Harris campaign fund. She is a candidate. Yeah. She would remain a candidate. So she could use it in any way she wanted to. If it were another nominee, that money could be donated to the Democratic National Committee, and it could use the money. So the money wouldn't go to waste. I think any candidate would, you know, they'd have to raise money. They would have to generate interest. I think there would be excitement associated with the drive to get people to get a new person nominated. And, of course, major donors would come in because, I mean, the fear of Trump getting elected, which motivates so many people like my friend Solomon to stay with Biden, is also motivating the people are saying we need to make a change here. But it could be done. It could be done.
And Julian, I want to ask you, you wrote an opinion piece arguing that Vice President Kamala Harris is the key to Biden's survival, but she has a big job to do. Can you lay out your argument how Harris is, you believe, a critical aspect of switching it out or surviving this campaign?
Yeah, I mean, that was written about surviving. And I think the Biden presidency and reelection has always depended in some ways on perceptions of her as a potential successor, meaning in the second term, should something happen, or a governing partner to the president. I don't think the administration has always thought of her this way. But the more they can elevate her and the more confidence she can instill in the coming weeks as Biden tries to do the same, I think that only strengthens the chances of him staying and Democrats rallying around him. And obviously, if he decides not to run, she still remains the most formidable Democrat. She can run on the administration's record. She's been tested on the national stage. And I understand all the polling about her, but it will be different when she's the candidate than the vice president. So I think she is pretty integral to the party. A lot of these other candidates who are very promising, exciting, have not been on the national stage with this intensity yet. So the risks are quite high. And that's why in both cases, I think the vice president could be pretty pivotal to how this unfolds.
Susan from Doylestown says, I support Biden, and he has a strong vice president who will step up if needed. Echoing your point, Julian. Fran from Westchester says she'll vote for Biden. And we're talking about whether or not Biden should or should not leave this race. Our email is studio2@whyy.org. Our number is 888-477-9499. You are listening to Studio 2. Julian Zelizer, you brought up the polls and how other, you know, theoretical candidates poll. My sense is that there's not a lot of good data out there, but can you give us a sense of what the data says and what you read into the polling that does exist?
Well, the polling I've seen suggests that Biden is still the strongest of the lot, although there's new polls suggesting that's changing. Harris still seems to be the strongest, but again, she's the most well-known. So it's different to say, how does Harris or Biden look today vis-a-vis Governor Whitmer, Governor Shapiro, or Governor Newsom, versus how do they look if this becomes open and they are campaigning and there's town halls and debates on television? So, I mean, it's limited what we have right now. We do know none of the candidates have really, at least the ones being mentioned, have been under this kind of scrutiny yet. So, you know, I think as we speak, the vice president, if this would happen, remains the strongest option.
Yeah. And I want to play this clip because we went out and talked to some voters. Take a listen.
Listen, I'm going to vote for Biden. If he's on hospice, I'm going to be voting for him.
And that's Marissa Wick, a Democrat from Center City, who spoke with our producer, Andreas Copes. And this goes to my question to you, Solomon Jones. I want to talk about the impact on potential voters. Yes. If there was a switch. I mean, folks, millions of Americans went to the vote, to the ballot, you know, box on primary day in their individual states. If the Democratic Party were to do a switcheroo, what would it do to the confidence of voters, given the fact that they chose one candidate and all of a sudden now the Democratic Party is going to present someone else?
I think there's already some uncertainty in the Democratic Party around whatever candidate is going to be put up, whether it's Biden or whether it's somebody else. One of the things that I keep hearing is that both parties are the same, right? No matter what happens, things aren't going to get better for us. And I hear that a lot in the black community. But I hear it in other places as well. And so I think that voters, if they are voting against Trump, will vote for whatever Democratic candidate is in place. But if they are these independent voters, these swing voters that really are needed in order for a Democratic victory to take place, well, then all bets are off, because now you're running somebody who doesn't have a national profile, to Julian's point, who hasn't been tested on the national stage and who hasn't been tested against Trump. Joe Biden is the guy who beat Donald Trump. Who else you got? That's the question.
Yeah.
Right. Who else do you have that's actually going to win?
And we're going to start talking about that. But I hear the folks saying, I'd vote for him on hospice.
That's right.
That's where people are.
Harry from Northeast Philly says there are so many talented Democratic governors out there. They can and should replace Biden. Solomon Jones, what about those governors? Shapiro, Newsom, Whitmer, those are the three names you always hear.
Right. So, again, Gavin Newsom, left-leaning.
From California.
From California.
Same places.
Probably on the national stage, too far to the left. Gretchen Whitmer, you had the most qualified female candidate in Hillary Clinton ever run for the presidency. She lost. And so that's going to be a knock against her. Josh Shapiro, very pro-Israel. He is Jewish at this time. It might be a risk for him, even though he's got policies that are very much in the center and not necessarily to the left or the right. So
also again, not been on the stage. I mean, he's been in statewide office for a while, but he's only been the governor for a short period of time.
And all of those things, I think you have to consider Who is the candidate? What is their identity? How would they do nationally when you have an electorate that is not your left-leaning electorate that you would have in a place like California?
Well, we have to take a break now, but I just want to reintroduce our panel. We have Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, co-editor of a new book out this month, Our Nation at Risk, Election Integrity as a National Security Issue. You also just heard from Solomon Jones, columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer and a WURD radio host, and Dave Davies, guest host for NPR's Fresh Air and a former WHYY political reporter. Our question this hour: should President Joe Biden leave the presidential race? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email us, studio2@whyy.org. We have a lot more coming up after a brief break on Studio 2. Stick with us.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are continuing our conversation about whether or not President Joe Biden should step aside. If the Democrats have a better shot against former President Trump with someone else at the top of the ticket, and if so, who? We want to hear what you think. Should President Joe Biden step aside? You can call us 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. Thanks to everybody who's been calling and emailing our three guests. I'm going to reintroduce them. Solomon Jones, a columnist with the Philadelphia Inquirer and a host on WURD Radio. We have Dave Davies, a guest host for NPR's Fresh Air and a former WHYY political reporter. We also have Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. He is the co-editor of a new book out this month. It's called Our Nation at Risk, Election Integrity as a National Security Issue. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for being here. And we want to bring in a caller. We have Monica from Montgomery County who has some concerns about the vice president on the ticket. Monica, you're on Studio 2. What is your question or comment?
Okay, I guess question and comment. and I know we're talking about the top of the ticket with Biden. What have you found the consensus or the polling, if any, of the option of having the vice president, Kamala Harris, step down and another candidate come in to run with Biden? Getting opinions and asking around in my community and in Philly where I work, I hear this often. Not too happy with Kamala. And definitely will be Biden. Most of them, definitely Biden, going to vote for Biden over Trump no matter what. But some that are not going to vote at all, even though they don't want Trump in. That's where I'm at, that if it was more appealing or more pull, and I'm just saying this because it will never happen, but, hey, you put Michelle Obama in there with Biden, you're going to landslide, you know?
That's interesting.
Yeah. And people have said that.
Like, right. Mm-hmm. Monica, thanks so much for that call. Like, that's an interesting alternative,
very
right? Re-energizing the ticket, not by replacing the top, but just by getting someone new in the vice presidency role. Julian Zelizer, has that happened before? Is that an approach someone could take? I mean, that's a pretty off-the-wall idea, but it does seem like it's time for off-the-wall ideas in the Democratic Party.
Well, FDR did it in 1944, and Harry Truman would go on to become president. So there is a precedent, but that could be very costly. I mean, I think there are many voters, including Black American voters, who already have had a pretty strained relation with the administration, according to polls, that might not respond well. Yes, Michelle Obama might step in, but there's zero indication she has any interest in doing this. Let's be realistic. She was uncomfortable with her husband's run. She just doesn't love politics. Yeah. So those come with costs. And again, a lot of these polls reflect Harris's vice president. I can't think of many vice presidents who are loved. Most people don't even know what they do. So I think some of the response to her is kind of imagined, and it's based on stories about how people think, as opposed to what would she look like if this comes to fruition and she's running and making her case, again, against opposition, an opponent that will instantly unify Democrats should they be confident and comfortable about the campaign.
And I want to bring in March, who has a different perspective on Kamala Harris. March, you are on Studio 2. What is your question or comment?
Yes. I'm just wondering how Kamala Harris has proven herself on the national stage. And I think that Joe Biden is in trouble. Democratic Party's in trouble, and I don't see a solution.
Thank you.
I think
March.
That's a response to someone earlier saying that she has proven herself on the national stage. She's certainly been on the national stage. Solomon Jones, can you take that one?
Kamala Harris ran for president. She was one of the major candidates for president. She actually engaged Biden on stage in ways that the other candidates appeared to be afraid to. And she was a major law enforcement figure in California. And so she has been on the national stage, both as a candidate and as the vice president. She's been touring the country as part of the campaign and as a senator as well. And a senator who, again, was involved in major legislation. And so I don't know where the notion comes from that she has not proven herself on the national stage. She's been on the national stage in pretty big ways.
And I think Dave sort of touched on this a little bit. What would happen? Let's be theoretical. If you were to pass over a Kamala Harris, what could possibly be the result of replacing her at the top of the ticket if President Joe Biden were to step aside? And Dave, Solomon, jump in, whoever.
Well, black people would be angry. I'm going to tell you straight up.
You're going to say that Solomon says black folks would be pissed.
From the very the minute that you do that, people will see that as racism. People will see that as the Democratic Party.
She's next in line
and
skipped over her.
That's right.
Yeah.
And probably sexism, because they may not replace her with a woman.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that,
let me just
the ticket already has a problem with black support. Black enthusiasm, at least.
And Julian, you wanted to chime in on this?
Yeah, and just to add, I mean, President Biden, who the caller is saying is very loved and strong, he ran many unsuccessful campaigns. I mean, so it's not as if he was always this strong candidate. 2020 was his year. So in addition to all the experience people are talking about with the vice president, it doesn't mean because she lost that primary that she can't win right now. And I think there's many formidable skills she brings to the table.
Yeah, need we forget, Joe Biden ran for president in 1988. So, you know, he's had plenty of campaigns, not all of them successful. Mm-hmm. I want to bring in this comment from Christine, who says, "My head says, no, he shouldn't step down. Why? The top overarching, perhaps only issue has become the recent Supreme Court decision on immunity and which candidate does the American electorate truly trust with king/dictator-like power." That's what Christine says. And Dave, I want to bring you into this conversation because we're trying to suss out what's happening with the polling. We're trying to suss out where the momentum is. Another huge thing happened while all of this was happening with the debate fallout. Give us a sense of how you think that might play in the election.
Well, you know, I think Democrats think that Trump is a disaster and an existential threat to American democracy, and this Supreme Court ruling only reinforces that.
Yeah.
You know, I think we got to recognize that most votes are already spoken for in this election. I mean, Democrats are going to vote against Trump, and Trump supporters, the hardcore, are going to vote for him no matter what. this is going to be decided by a relative handful of voters in a few swing states. And there's a woman named Sarah Longwell, who was a Republican operative who is now headed a group of anti-Trump Republicans. And she does focus groups with voters. And she did, after the election, after the debate, did some focus groups involving voters who had voted twice for Trump but who are now not sure about it. Also, people who had voted for Trump in 2016, then Biden in 2020, and then are unsure about it. And she'd been talking to these people since 2023. And in a podcast recently, she said, you know, back in 2023, they were saying my main problem with Biden is he is too old. He looks frail. He doesn't look ready for this.
That's way before the debate.
Way before the debate. And It was clear that the Biden campaign in part scheduled the debate to address this question, because there were these nagging polls. They were lagging behind in swing states, and they really needed to do something to put that issue aside. And so to set this debate head-to-head on Trump, give him several days at Camp David to get ready and bring his best stuff, and it was a disaster. I mean, it wasn't just that he had a cold or spoke weakly. I mean, he wasn't making sense at times. I mean, there was the, you know, we beat Medicare comment, the bizarre thing about the trimester analysis when talking about, you know, abortion, which should be a winning issue for him again and again. And I think the fear is, is this going to keep happening? You know, and there was another piece in the Times, besides the one we spoke about, which talked about how people are seeing this more and more among
Biden's inner circle.
Yeah. You know, when he was in Europe, how European leaders said there were times when they would kind of shield him from photographers because they could see. Now, certainly times when he was really sharp and focused and cogent, but I think this issue is just not going to go away. And I think there's risk for the Democratic Party, whatever happens here.
Yeah.
But I think they would be wise to think about whether this performance is not going to be repeated again and again. And, you know, those people who are ready to vote against Trump because they don't really like him, they need to see an alternative that seems safe.
Mm. Yeah. And Virgil comments on this. He says, there are people who would vote for Biden under any circumstances, but for the rest, he is a weak candidate at best, given what appears to be more than just age. The undecideds are the one who matter. And so we only have a couple more minutes, but I want to sort of really give a true understanding of what is at stake here. I want you to take a moment, Solomon, what is really at stake when the Democrats, when President Biden is considering whether he should step aside, when voters are considering who to vote for, what is at stake?
The future of our democracy is at stake. The future of our country is at stake. The safety of our people is at stake. Think about the Supreme Court decision, which said that any official act falls under the umbrella of immunity. And so does that mean sending troops into a city when people are protesting? Does that mean locking up your rivals? Does it mean saying I'm not leaving and having a military coup? Like, what does that mean? I did it and it was under my official duties. I think that it is a dangerous place to put that kind of power into the hands of a convicted felon. Surrounded by people who are going to prison or have been to prison or are on their way to prison, and someone who has shown that they have no scruples or morals where power is concerned. Absolute power corrupts, and it corrupts absolutely. And so I think that the very future of our nation is at stake. It's that big.
Julian Zelizer, I think we're going to have to give you the last word here. Talking about this latest immunity decision from the Supreme Court, is it a chance to refocus the campaign and in some ways, I believe, amplify the fear of a Trump presidency from the Democratic side?
Yes. The theoretical fears that have emerged because of the decision have to be connected by Democrats to the very real possibility that aggressive, extraordinarily no guardrails, strong presidential power is months away from being deployed. Should Donald Trump be the president. And Democrats need to make clear what those risks are, what that would look like, and shift the conversation back to that threat to our democratic institutions as opposed to President Biden's debate performance.
There are a lot of comments we did not get to today,
we
apologize, but it was a bubbling fertile conversation, and we're going to keep it going because I can't imagine this is the last time we're going to be talking about topics like this. I want to thank all of our panelists today, Julian Zelizer, Solomon Jones, Dave Davies, and thank you to our listeners for all of the great questions and comments. That's it for Studio 2 this week, Cherry.
Yes, and have a wonderful 4th of July holiday. Our show is produced by Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Besser, and Andreas Copes. Kevin McCrory is the executive producer. Diana Martinez is our engineer. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Like Cherry said, have a wonderful and safe 4th. We'll talk to you next week.